Hi, folks. I'm Drew Carey. As you know, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I love Cleveland, Ohio. I based my whole career on being from Cleveland, Ohio. And you also might know that Cleveland, Ohio is going through some tough times right now. The economy is in trouble. Schools are in trouble. And people have been leaving the city in droves for a long, long time. And it's not just Cleveland. It's a lot of cities in the country are having the same problems. And I went to the folks at the Reason Foundation, and I said, is there any way that we can come up with some ideas to help save Cleveland? And we looked at some best practices at other cities around the country, and we wanted to know if we applied them to Cleveland, would it do any good? The series is called Reason Saves Cleveland. Hope you like it.
Post-war years were a golden age for Cleveland, a city built on a rock-solid foundation of steel mills, heavy manufacturing, and shipping. In 1950, Cleveland was the sixth largest city in the United States with a population of nearly 1 million people. The city's economic strength was mirrored on the playing fields of the NFL and Major League Baseball, as athletic heroes like Bob Feller and Lou the Toe Groza brought championships to Cleveland. In the 1950s, Northeast Ohio appeared to be a place of limitless possibilities.
Almost 2 million people live and work here and recognize this area as the best location in the nation.
So how did the best location in the nation become the mistake on the lake? Cleveland's tale of decline is familiar to all inhabitants of Rust Belt cities. It's a story punctuated by economic downturns, population decline, and social unrest.
It was really like a racially divided city, Cleveland, you ask anybody.
In 1966, racial tensions came to a head, culminating in the Huff race riots. As with Newark and Detroit, the riots created a sense that Cleveland had become ungovernable. In 1969, as the nation began to develop an environmentalist sensibility, the massively polluted Cuyahoga River actually caught fire, providing an iconic and disturbing image of an unlivable urban hellhole.
I went to the beach once downtown, and there was nothing but dead fish all over the beach and stuff, so it was horrible.
In the 1970s, pitched battles about racial desegregation in Cleveland's public schools pitted blacks against whites and liberals against conservatives.
And Charlotte, what was your initial reaction when you found out Todd would have to be bussed away?
Well, I felt that I'd rather go to jail than have him bussed across town.
The busing controversy increased flight from the city and created an even bleaker future for Cleveland's public schools. The bad economy of the 1970s hit Cleveland especially hard, as heavy industry jobs increasingly relocated to the South or outside the United States altogether. And in 1978, under the guidance of boy mayor Dennis Kucinich, Cleveland made history by defaulting on a $15 million loan.
I mean, it was just a national joke. The whole city was.
By 1980, Cleveland had lost a third of its population. And when the city's once great sports franchises weren't slumping, they were breaking the hearts of their fans. An infamous last-minute fumble in the 1988 AFC Championship game seemed to perfectly capture the spirit of a city whose future had slipped through its fingers.
Reaching in to strip that ball away.
Don't worry about it, Ernest. We all still love you.
Despite lavish public spending on things like sports stadiums and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Cleveland in the 21st century remains mired in a 1970s-era funk of double-digit unemployment and population flight. Cleveland has lost more than half of its population since 1950 and routinely ranks as one of the poorest big cities in the United States. More than 10,000 vacant homes in the city act as a constant reminder of Cleveland's economic catastrophe. Is a Cleveland Renaissance possible? Of course it is.
Follow the rainbow and fell to the ground. You gotta be down.
To get a handle on the kinds of problems Cleveland is facing today, we spoke to Clevelanders from all walks of life. Then we traveled the country looking for innovative ways to fix Cleveland schools, encourage redevelopment, and bring back businesses and people. Join us as we learn how to fix the mistake on the lake and other once great U.S. cities.
Your choice is, you know, go to a Catholic school or get the hell out of town and raise your kid somewhere else. That's not much of a choice at all.
Do you like the Cleveland schools?
Yeah.
They can't afford to have social workers and deal with the violence and the anger and the poverty.
They don't care about us.
Despite spending around $14,000 per student, Cleveland public schools are not making the grade. Only 12% of Cleveland's district and charter schools merit a state rating of excellent or even effective.
What's the role of education in the decline of Cleveland proper?
I'm actually going through a really big time in our lives. We have a 4.5-year-old. We live in Tremont. We live in Cleveland proper. We've lived there for 10 years. And all of a sudden I'm going, oh my gosh, do I have to leave the city that I love?
Most people aren't willing to live in the city today if they have children, if they can afford to be out of the city.
7 years ago, we had 70,000 students. Now we only have 50,000.
Who's in a suburb? Okay, you're all in a suburb.
Arguably, no issue is more vital to a city's prosperity than K-12 education. If it's bad, it drives out young families with kids and fails to prepare young people for the workforce. Any plan to revitalize the city must radically improve K-12 education. We asked Cleveland City Council member Kevin Kelly how to fix the problem.
What's the single biggest thing that Cleveland could do to jack up its education level among its citizens?
I don't have a good answer to that.
Cleveland's public education woes are hardly unique. All over the U.S., urban schools that serve low-income minority students are failing. We went to the flatlands of Oakland, California, a low-income area populated mostly by Latinos and African Americans. A few years ago, parents and educators were as frustrated with their failing schools as Clevelanders are today.
Most teachers felt disrespected. They felt like cogs in a machine, and students felt the same way. I left teaching pretty much because I felt really burned out. I had to step back and assess.
David Silver had a similarly frustrating experience as a teacher in a public school in Compton and later Oakland.
Then I saw the statistic that only 1 out of 20 kids was eligible to go to a University of California school, and I saw that there was an opportunity to start a new school. Oakland Unified had passed this resolution that 10 new schools could start and that you could have autonomy and flexibility with respect to budget, curriculum, and staffing. And I said, huh, maybe this is the ticket.
Silver accepted the challenge and co-founded Think College Now, where he's now the principal. TCN is a small, autonomous K-5 school that is achieving extraordinary results. 68% of TCN students are English language learners, none of whom were reading at grade level when the school started. Today, 60% of TCN's English language learners are proficient or advanced readers.
I love TCN. Because, you know, we're all a very big family here.
I will. Go to college.
Go to college.
Yes, I can.
The combination of autonomy and accountability was so successful in Oakland's small schools that the school board eventually adopted a policy they called results-based budgeting, district-wide.
I always say to a teacher at our school, like, look, I have total trust in you to reach these results. You tell me, as the principal, what you need, and I'm going to make it happen. I couldn't say that with it were it not for results-based budgeting.
I'm able to teach what I want to teach, and as long as I show results, I feel like I'm respected as a professional. I'm really glad I'm here.
Hey, this stuff works. People that want to be innovative, people that want to be held accountable for results, they're going to come. And people that want the status quo, they may leave, and that may be okay.
These children could be the first generation of college students. You know? So it's hope. Yeah.
Oakland has had some of the highest achievement growth of any urban district over the last 3 years in California. If it can happen here, it can happen in Cleveland.
It seems simple. Giving schools more autonomy can lead to the kinds of results we all want for our children. In fact, it's already happening at Citizens Academy, a K-5 charter school in Cleveland.
Citizens Academy is a great school, and I love to come here. I've been here ever since kindergarten.
Basically, these kids come by and large from Huff, Glenville, Kinsman, I mean, really some of the poorest neighborhoods of one of the poorest big cities in America.
What kind of results have you shown over the past few years?
Ohio has about a 30 percentage point achievement gap between African-American students and white students. And last year, our students overcame that achievement gap. They actually outperformed the statewide average for non-minority students by about 7 percentage points.
It's just total difference. You know, they teach respect, discipline, honesty, and I don't think that the Cleveland Public Schools, you know, have an emphasis on all of those things.
Talk a little bit about how a charter school is different from a traditional public school or even a magnet school.
Different is, first of all, in the funding. While we receive the state and federal funding, we do not receive any local public dollars. And that works out to a difference of around $5,000 per child annually.
So you're getting $5,000 less, but you're kicking ass on test scores.
Right.
Do you get paid the same as if you were at a traditional public school?
You know, you get paid a little bit less. So I think the people that are here are doing it for a reason. If they wanted more money, they could go somewhere else.
How do you like teaching here?
I love it. I've been in parochial schools as well as the public system. There's no micromanaging here. There's a lot of freedom to experiment. If I have an idea, I can go right to the top and I'm listened to.
You're not part of a centralized system. You're a school district of one. How important is that autonomy to being able to succeed or to try new things?
For Citizens Academy, I would say it's vital. We have a very specific mission here, and we have a very different way of doing things that is proven. We are trying to save children's lives here.
Cleveland Citizens Academy and Oakland's Think College Now are proof that urban schools can succeed. So why doesn't Cleveland implement reforms that will lead to innovation and improve results? One of the biggest reasons is that politically powerful teachers' unions are resistant to change.
How do the unions affect education in the CPS? Are they a force for good or are they a force for bad?
They're a force. Let me just say that one way or another.
Like maybe hiring teachers based on seniority isn't the best idea because just hanging around doesn't make you good.
I think the biggest issue with teachers' unions today is that they're lobbyists. They're spending millions and millions of dollars lobbying for issues that, frankly, have nothing to do with education.
What are the teachers' union's attitudes towards charter schools?
I think that there are certainly elements in the Cleveland Teachers Union, you know, that see us as a threat, that see us as competition, and I think that's good.
Yeah.
Hopefully it, you know, encourages them to step their game up a little.
Cleveland's leaders should work with the teachers' unions to increase autonomy and accountability at school sites. Even better, they should look at a promising new approach called weighted student funding. The way it works is that the money, which varies depending on each individual student's needs, follows the child. Parents choose among traditional charter and private schools that compete for students.
Do you think that that's an innovation that's worth thinking about having funding dollars follow the student?
Yeah, I've heard it referred to as the backpack approach, and I really think that it makes a lot of sense.
It would be best for the parents and families to have choice, send their kids where they want, make the schools compete against each other.
Schools of choice are the way to go, and that's the way it is once you get to college.
The future economic viability of our city and our region absolutely depend on the quality of our education.
Do you want to go to college?
Yes.
Yeah? Do you know what college you want to go to?
I think I might go to Ohio State.
Do Clevelanders need a public option when it comes to things like golfing and farmers markets?
No, of course not.
Then why do they keep paying for them?
You got me, brother.
We're here at the West Side Market, a vital part of Cleveland since 1912.
What's the kind of historic role of the West Side Market in Cleveland as an institution or a place of business?
It's families helping families here.
You cannot find anywhere in Cleveland more varieties of potatoes.
Okay, and shallots?
14!
Okay.
West Side Market is a great place to buy groceries, but the vendors who rent stalls here have plenty of complaints.
So what needs to get done that's not getting done?
Everything from the sewers to water lines to backups.
In the restroom upstairs, you have hot water and cold water. cold water. When you wash your hands, you have to move your hands like that.
Just letting the place fall apart.
The city doesn't have $20 to buy a faucet.
So who's running this place anyway?
My name is George Braddock, and I am the manager of the West Side Market.
George works for the city of Cleveland, which owns and operates the West Side Market.
Are you happy with the way the city runs the building and runs the market?
No.
In an age when most grocery stores are open 24 hours a day, the West Side Market is only open 4 days a week. Does that make good business sense?
Does the market make money for the city?
No.
We heard a similar story at Highland Hills Golf Course, which is also owned by the city. Even though the greens fees are some of the lowest in the city, play has been down in recent years. Between 2001 and 2005, the number of rounds played at Highland Hills dropped by nearly 50%.
I think this golf course is shortchanged. Look at the grass and tell that it's some of it is not cut and some of it is cut.
It's no surprise that golfers don't want to play at courses that aren't well maintained. For only a few bucks more per round, Clevelanders can go to Briarwood, a privately owned course just down the road from Seneca, Cleveland's other municipally owned golf course.
How does your course compare to the two courses that the city of Cleveland owns and operates?
It's well above theirs.
Do you guys golf at the Cleveland courses at all, the two courses that Cleveland owns and operates?
No.
Feed off.
Are golf courses a kind of core business that a city should be figuring out how to run and to be expert at?
Probably not, because you'd like to actually have someone that's been in the business or knows more about it.
Is it surprising to you that the publicly owned and operated golf courses and markets are inferior to the privately owned ones?
Does it surprise you?
We're all familiar with the saying, good enough for government work. But maybe Cleveland taxpayers deserve better than good enough. Is there any evidence that private firms can do a better job, whether we're talking about running a golf course or paving city streets? We went to Chicago, a city that has privatized a number of its assets recently through a process called public-private partnerships.
This entire section underneath the new Millennium Park, which was built with largely private donations and private funds, is the largest underground parking system in the world. That system has all been, was formerly owned by the government, by the city, and now it's been privatized.
Michael Smith is an attorney at Baker & McKenzie. Over the past few years, Michael has represented firms bidding to lease city assets.
The first privatization was the Skyway. It's a large privatization. It was the Skyway, which is just out there on the horizon. And then the parking meters along Columbus and Michigan Avenue and then throughout the rest of the city were privatized after that. The marketplace is looking at these assets and saying, this is the money that the government's generating out of the asset. Look at how much more can be captured if you take it into a private regime.
Not only has Chicago generated more than $3.5 billion during its recent leasing spree, but the operating firms are investing millions more in order to provide better service. Many of Chicago's 36,000 meters are being replaced by solar-powered meters that accept credit cards. And the parking garage beneath Millennium Park now offers shuttle service to Soldier Field when the Bears are in town.
In most publicly run assets, there's efficiencies that can be gained when you bring revenue into the equation as the central important function of the asset. When the government's doing it, sometimes they're not necessarily thinking about that.
What is the kind of total volume of business that's done here?
If you're speaking about dollar-wise, I couldn't answer that.
There are critics, of course, who are uncomfortable with private entities operating assets that have long been run by the city. Others worry about fee increases.
What we had in Chicago and what you have in most cities is a subsidized meter system. And you had the private parking garages having to compete with that lower number. The meters were cheap, but there was no parking because the price wasn't set to the demand.
Cruising for street parking is a needless waste of resources, and it contributes significantly to downtown traffic congestion. According to studies, something like 30% of the congestion in downtown commercial districts is a direct result of cruising. In Chicago today, not only is there less congestion, but the private firms that provide parking in the city are now competing on an even playing field. The biggest opponents to privatization are often unionized city employees like George, who are afraid they'll lose their jobs. But that need not be the case.
One of the concessions that's been pretty common in most of the privatizations, both in the U.S. and internationally, is for the existing employees of the privatized system to be entitled to continue in their current function, whatever that may be. The bidders will say, this is what I'll bid if I don't have to take on all the existing employees, and this is what I'll bid if I do.
Privatization is really nothing new, but it's becoming an increasingly attractive option for cash-strapped cities across the country. We spoke with one of the nation's leading experts on privatization to learn more about the process.
My name is Steve Goldsmith. I'm a professor of government and director of the Innovations in American Government program at Harvard.
As mayor of Indianapolis for two terms in the 1990s, Goldsmith privatized a number of city assets as well as 80 city services through a managed competition process.
And every time we created a competitive bidding platform, on an average, we saved 25%. And the cumulative effect of those competitions was about $450 million in savings. And more importantly, every time we saved a dollar, we actually increased the quality of the work.
Managed competition allows public unions to bid for contracts along with private entities. But at least at first, the unions resisted.
In our city, we had 7 AFSCME unions that were very anxious at the beginning of the process. They were really mad about privatization. They were anxious about competition. But what happened over time was that the men and women who actually did the work came out ahead, because sometimes they would bid and win. Sometimes they would bid and lose, but the winning vendor would take the employees. They would come up with systems where the workers could do more, could have more discretion, could earn more money.
This privatization stuff seems like a good deal for citizens and, amazingly enough, for union members who are willing to compete as well. Are there other benefits?
One of the key benefits, in particular for Chicago with what we've just gone through with Blagojevich and our history, our long history, is that privatization adds transparency to government.
A little transparency would do wonders for the Cleveland metro area, where FBI agents have recently unearthed widespread corruption among local officials.
It's easier to run a government when you don't have commercial jobs to hand out to people and commercial contracts to give people. It takes the candy away from the kids.
It's clear that privatizing assets and opening city services to a managed competition process can make cities more efficient and better able to take care of core functions like maintaining infrastructure. But how can a city like Cleveland generate the necessary political consensus?
People who are wealthy, they can move or they can buy their services. Right? So the systems today, these bureaucratic systems, are unfair to the people who are poorest and locked in those communities. So let's make the case for change to them.
If the building was sold to a private operator, do you think that would be better for you or worse for you?
It would be better for the general public.
Privatization projects generate cash, increase the quality of city services, and help make governments more transparent. What's not to like? Come on, Cleveland, privatize it.
With the internet and everything, you could be almost anywhere to have a business, and people really do shop around.
If the jobs come back real strong, I'd move back to Florida in a heartbeat.
Listen, it's easier to move out of the city than it is to move in, and that's a problem.
Times are tough in Cleveland, but it wasn't always like this. In the 1950s, business was booming and the Indians and the Browns dominated. Those were the good old days.
When Cleveland was going, you had the Westinghouse building, you had Ever Ready Battery, you had a million print shops, you had a million people.
It used to be the sixth largest city in the United States, but that was back during the heyday of steel and a lot of things that were going right business-wise. All of that dried up in the 70s, and it's been a steady decline since then.
When the jobs left, the people followed. Today, Cleveland is the 41st largest city in the U.S. with a population of just 435,000. If Cleveland is to rebound, it needs to be the kind of place where businesses can flourish. How would you define the city's business climate?
I would say the city's business climate is robust.
Michael D'Aloia has a different perspective. As Cleveland's tech czar during Mayor Jane Campbell's administration earlier this decade, his task was to convince high-tech firms to relocate to Cleveland.
Every time I would go out to a tech company, I can tell you the same exact conversation I would have. And the idea was like, hey, I want you to move into the city of Cleveland. And the response was, you have to be out of your f***ing mind.
Though he had no staff or budget, D'Aloia was able to offer companies affordable and funky office space in places like the Tyler Elevator Building. In 3 years, Michael managed to lure 37 high-tech firms to Cleveland. But that was only the first step. Part of Michael's job was to help these companies navigate the city's regulatory system.
What were the recurring obstacles to developing?
Well, a lot of it was in permitting and inspection. It was not a fleet-moving organization.
While Cuyahoga County has seen some growth in high-tech and medical fields, it's lost more than 100,000 manufacturing jobs in the past 10 years. When we asked Clevelanders why businesses weren't thriving, they gave us two reasons: taxes and red tape.
My only experience in running a city is SimCity, the computer game. I know when you raise taxes, all the Sims leave the city.
There are entire neighborhoods on the east side that are completely abandoned and empty, so the property tax that the city once enjoyed is gone. It lives on employment tax. You've got companies leaving en masse.
Cleveland's economic death spiral has coincided with a gradual increase in state and local taxes in the Buckeye State. In 1977, Ohio ranked 45th in the nation in terms of its tax burden. In 2008, it ranked 7th. Today, Cleveland seems to be more focused on tax revenue than it is on the overall business climate.
Whenever a new business comes in, the first thought is, how much tax revenue will that be? We talk about jobs too, and it's good for people to have jobs. But even then, we look at the employees that would come in for that business as expanding the tax base.
Clevelanders not only pay a lot of taxes, they also have to deal with an exceedingly complex tax system. In addition to federal and state income taxes, people in Northeast Ohio are burdened by local sales and property taxes, as well as city payroll taxes that average around 2%.
It is not the sort of simple tax system that encourages economic activity.
For people to say that the climate is anti-business, don't know the ward that I represent, and don't know the business people that I'm proud to take care of at the city.
But most of the people aren't saying that the people are anti-business, but mm-hmm. that City Hall throws up a lot of roadblocks that
Who's
are unnecessary.
That?
Various business owners we've talked to.
Can I ask you?
Since so many of the disgruntled business owners we spoke to were afraid to appear on camera, we didn't give any names to Joe. But we did find a few brave souls who were willing to speak candidly about the red tape in Cleveland.
I think the city wants to work with you. I think some of the staff does not work as maybe expedient as the private sector would like things to move. So I call it architecture by persistence.
I had a time frame as to when I was going to start and when I was going to finish. Of course, that never works out the way you anticipate, but you also would hope that when you're ready to start demolition, that the city doesn't tell you, no, you have to wait for 3 more months for us to approve your plans.
This poor guy across the street from me went there to get a sign put up on his building. Little sign on a brick building in an area that's now deserted. Well, who cares? He goes to the design review thing, and they want him to bring a drawing, bring another sign, try this sign, but it's a sign.
In Cleveland, you can need a permit for a pool table, or if you want to have a DJ spin records in a restaurant on a Friday night. That's not the sort of environment that's welcoming to business and that's welcoming to entrepreneurship.
Any investment that comes in will end up going to a suburb anyway, because who wants to deal with these people?
This is the Board of Zoning Appeals, where many of the battles between business people and City Hall are fought.
This is beyond ridiculous.
In Cleveland, like many other older cities, the way you get things done is to lick the boots of the city's politicians in the hope that they'll champion your cause.
And really, my job is to be the needle and thread until we get it done.
Could you talk about a case where you helped a small business cut through red tape just so a businessman could get on with
Sure.
buying and selling stuff?
Morgan Linen is the only linen company left in the city of Cleveland. The neighbors agreed to this change in zoning so he could expand his parking lot to pull the cars off the street and he could actually hire more people. He not only had to navigate the city's building and housing department, he also had to navigate the sewer department because of the irrigation. He had to navigate the county because of the taxation and the way they were billing, and he had to navigate how he was going to consolidate his lots so that the zoning would be in total and not just for one. He was trying to do this for the last decade, and we got involved and were actually able to help him in about a year and a half.
There's got to be a better way. We went to Houston, a city without a state or local income tax, where we spoke to businessman Dan Bello about Houston's business climate. Bello is the chairman of the Greater Houston Partnership.
We have 29, I think, Fortune 500 companies headquartered here in Houston. But you know what? The majority of the employment base comes from small businesses, people who employ less than 100 people. And those are the people you really need to support. You need to make it easy for them to do business. You need to make it affordable from a tax point of view.
The assumption in Houston is you should be able to do what you want to do unless there's a really good reason why you shouldn't do it. In many cities, it's completely the opposite. You shouldn't be able to do anything unless you kiss X number of rings or X number of tukuses, you know, depending how you want to put it.
Jordi Blanchet is the general manager of a brand new Beventura manufacturing plant in Houston.
Our company is producing mainly parts for the automotive sector. It's all turned parts. We have screw machines around 20 in Spain, and here we are planning to have like 3 or 4 the first year.
Jordi's Barcelona-based company could have set up shop anywhere in the U.S., including a traditional manufacturing town like Cleveland, but the company chose Houston.
Before coming here, we get a study made from the Chamber of Commerce of Barcelona, and they decided that Houston was a good area because they told us that it was very easy to just set up the company.
In fact, Jordi and his colleagues were able to complete all the paperwork to set up shop in Houston in a single afternoon.
So really, that's something that it shocked me because, in Spain, if you want to set up a company, you need almost like 5 months or 6 months. It's not that easy.
Why do 60,000 people move to Houston each year? They come for the opportunity and they stay because, if you believe publications like Forbes and Kiplinger, Houston is a great place to live, work, and play.
Why do we keep adding jobs? Why are you here talking to us? Something's working right.
So what can Cleveland learn from a city like Houston?
The best thing for a place like Cleveland to get business in there, and most of all if they want international business to go there, they have to make things easier.
Cleveland's not going to attract people because of its beaches or because of its mild winters. It's going to attract people if this is a place where they can reap the returns on their investments and make a good life for themselves.
It's a bottom line thing for businesses. They want lower taxes and less red tape. Simple as that. Those are the kind of things I've heard my whole life, though, is, you know, what we need to solve everything is a plan for me, politician, whoever, and all my buddies. And we'll make sure this will bring people downtown if we just put this in.
Like a lot of cities with dying downtowns, Cleveland is desperate to revitalize its center city. Cleveland's leaders have bet huge amounts of public dollars that big-ticket attractions will spur economic activity. During the 1990s, Cleveland marketed itself as the comeback city and invested hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and stadiums for the Browns, Indians, and Cavaliers.
The city of Cleveland is expert at building big white elephants and calling that economic development. And it doesn't work because if you look at the stadiums, you notice the buildings around it are empty.
The politicians who champion these corporate welfare projects promised that they would stimulate the local economy. And on the face of it, that's precisely what they appear to do.
They have a baseball game and a football game on the same day. 120,000 some people down there looking for parking, looking for places to eat, tipping the waiters, tipping the valet guys.
Sure, there's more action around the stadiums on game day. But economic studies consistently find that these kinds of publicly funded projects fail to increase the overall economic activity.
You're basically taking the entertainment dollar of a Clevelander and saying they're going to spend it here as opposed to there.
In pro sports, it's common practice for team owners to threaten to relocate if they don't receive public funding. And Clevelanders know all too well what it's like to lose a beloved team. But for a cash-strapped city like Cleveland, the price is too steep.
You take a city whose schools are crumbling, whose roads are crumbling, whose bridges are falling apart, whose economy is in terrible shape, and you're going to subsidize a billionaire team owner? Somehow it doesn't make sense to me.
City officials have not learned their lesson. The city's next redevelopment silver bullet is a new convention center that will require hundreds of millions of additional tax dollars.
I didn't know Cleveland was such a bustling convention city. Take that, Vegas.
Funded by an increase in the county sales tax, the hope is that the Medical Mart Convention Center will attract medical conventions to Cleveland. Lots of people are skeptical that the plan can work.
I personally don't agree with it. Maybe I'm wrong. But Pittsburgh built a convention center, and it's like an anchor dragging them down.
This whole tendency to put what are scarce public funds into convention centers, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, these sort of ephemeral projects, is delusional. Cleveland wasn't a tourist destination in its best days. It's certainly not going to be a tourist destination in its close to worst.
You'd think a city like Cleveland would welcome any company with open arms, especially companies that aren't asking for handouts. But guess what happened when retail giant Walmart came to town?
Wasn't asking for all sorts of new tax breaks or new subsidies. All it wanted was the ability to operate. And the response of the political process and a lot of local political activists was horror.
Political activists put pressure on the city council to change the zoning regulations in a dilapidated, underused section of town called the Steel Yards to prevent the superstore from opening in Cleveland. Dave's Market, a unionized grocery store chain in Cleveland, had the most to lose.
The belief was Dave's would somehow be compromised or unfairly competed against if, God forbid, another store would open, would offer similar products at lower prices.
After some political maneuvering, Walmart ultimately opened up for business in Cleveland. And unless you're a committed anti-Walmart activist, it's hard to argue that Walmart has been anything but good for the city.
There was a line when they first opened up the interviews, thousands of people seeking these jobs, jobs that we'd been told during the debate were going to be low wages and poor quality jobs, but yet thousands of people thought that these jobs were significantly better than the other opportunities they had.
When I come down here, I may go to Home Depot, but most of the time when I come down here, I'm coming to Walmart. They got everything I need and more.
But you like Walmart? You like the range of goods?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They got food. They got electronics. You know, you can come here and do all your shopping in one place.
All I know is every time they open a Walmart, there's an Applebee's right around the corner. That's okay with your care.
And what happened to Dave's Market? Realizing they couldn't compete with Walmart's low prices, the closest store changed its name to Dave's Mercado and now specializes in foods for the growing Latino community in the area. That's good, too. Restrictive zoning regulations are the weapons of choice for the powers that be in Cleveland.
If it's going to be a residential neighborhood, then it's going to be a residential neighborhood. If it's going to be single-family homes, then single-family homes it is. And then, you know, down the street, you can do something else. You can do condos, or you can do a high-rise apartment building or something fancier like that. But that just seems to be the way things work here. It's a very planning-oriented place.
So what's the alternative? Houston is booming in part because the city doesn't have heavy-handed land use policies.
Let's just face it. When you go to a city with zoning, what happens is once the land is zoned, the process to permit, the process to build and get approvals in certain cities in this country can take years.
Houston's freewheeling approach to redevelopment wasn't very popular with the Cleveland lawmakers we talked to.
Houston effectively has no zoning.
Yeah, that's a joke.
You know, in Houston, if we were to adopt that model, you could put a pawn shop mm-hmm. in the middle of a residential neighborhood, mm-hmm. and we don't want that.
Houston certainly does have its quirks. A case in point is the Beer Can House, the lifelong passion of Houston beer drinker and artist John Milkovich.
It's not perfect, believe me, but in a lot of ways, it's allowed Houston to grow more freely.
This is a zoning map of Cleveland, a city with 22 different zoning designations. And this is a land use map of Houston, where people are free to use their land as they please. Cities don't need central planners for redevelopment to happen. In fact, without zoning restrictions, growth happens organically, and that's the kind of growth that creates vibrant ethnic and entrepreneurial communities.
You go to Houston, you drive on Bel Air Road, and it's filled with dim sum places and Vietnamese restaurants.
And spontaneous redevelopment isn't the only benefit of minimal land use regulations.
Part of Houston's sort of free market approach to land use regulation is that we don't try to force all of our commercial skyscrapers downtown. We let them kind of set up wherever they like, and that has led to a clustering of various job districts around the city, sort of a decentralization.
Having multiple business districts eases traffic considerably. But most importantly, Houston's liberal land use policies encourage redevelopment by reducing costs for developers.
Approvals at City Hall and then permitting, I think we can do it in about half the time that you can around other parts of the country. That's flexibility, and that lowers a person's cost.
The top-down approach to redevelopment hasn't worked in Cleveland or anywhere else. It might just be that Cleveland needs more Walmarts and fewer convention centers. and fewer rules telling businesses where they can and cannot set up shop.
Having good sports teams is a good thing. Having people go to cultural destinations is a good thing. But if you don't have economic vibrancy, you're really not answering the fundamental question.
We can all make our own decisions. We all want to live our own kind of life. You don't need a centralized government to tell us what to do all the time and to tell us, you know, what color to paint our house and what, you know, what we can put where. We'll decide on our own. We'll work it out with our neighbors on our own. You can do Prices Right in Cleveland. I would love to move back. I hate Los Angeles.
No city can exist without people, and Cleveland has lost more than half its population since the 1950s, when nearly a million people lived in the city. Many moved to nearby suburbs, but even so, the population in the region has remained flat for decades. Given all of its problems, you might wonder why anyone would want to live in Cleveland. Well, for one thing, Clevelanders enjoy the kinds of big-ticket entertainment options you can only find in large cities. In addition to the Browns, Cavaliers, and Indians, and attractions like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Cleveland has a lot to offer people with a taste for high culture.
Well, I mean, we have a tremendous orchestra. I mean, one of the best in the world. The Art Museum is phenomenal.
I mean, Playhouse Square is the largest contiguous theater center in America outside Broadway.
These cultural attractions are great, but can they really do anything to help revitalize Cleveland?
We get it wrong. We think that it's the cultural amenities that drive the prosperity, when really it's the prosperity that drives the cultural amenities.
It's true. The orchestra, museum, and theaters in Cleveland are artifacts of an era when Cleveland was an industrial powerhouse and threw off tons of cash. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the sports complexes, on the other hand, were built with hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars and sweetheart deals during Cleveland's economic decline. These amenities are not the fruits of a vibrant economy. They're monuments to the empty promises of Cleveland politicians. And while the Cavaliers provide a great entertainment option for tourists from the suburbs, you can't judge a city's health by looking at its basketball team.
I mean, LeBron James is not going to save Cleveland.
So what else does Cleveland have going for it? Well, there's no denying that many people absolutely love the city. In fact, we found some interesting folks who were so charmed by Cleveland that they decided to move here. In a past life, Les Roberts was a Hollywood producer and writer for shows like The Hollywood Squares and The Lucy Show. He came to Cleveland for the first time in 1987.
And I didn't know anything about Cleveland when I got here. I knew about Jim Brown and Bob Feller and the river burning. I had no clue what the city was all about. And I was here for like 10 days and I fell in love with Cleveland.
Les moved to Cleveland a few years later and has been writing novels featuring Cleveland-based detective Milan Jakovic ever since. Taj Mihelic, a professional BMX rider who's lived in Austin for the past 15 years, recently decided to relocate to Cleveland.
From the first time I came here, I got this really strong feeling that this could be home, and it's a cool place.
So what exactly is so cool about Cleveland? We asked the best experts we could find, the people who live here.
What's great about Cleveland?
It's amazing. Okay. Have you been downtown?
We're right on the lake. We have great landscapes. We have great architecture.
There's a lot of industrial parts of Cleveland that have gone out of business, and so it's sort of like an urban jungle. There's a lot of opportunity and potential here.
There's something that feels lived in here, like a worn pair of jeans, you know?
Cleveland's a small, big town. I mean, big enough so that everybody doesn't know your business, yet small enough so you still have friends of a lifetime.
It's a great place to raise a family. It really is.
Cleveland is also an incredibly affordable place to live.
Because really, you work 20 hours a week in Cleveland, you can pay your rent. And you have a lot of time to do your art, and your space to rent is cheap.
What do homebuyers get for their money in Cleveland? We asked Katie Brailer, a local real estate agent.
I'm in front of a beautiful home in Cleveland, Ohio. This house has beautiful hardwood flooring, beautiful kitchen, 4-bedroom. It's only $132,000.
That's a lot of house for the money, but for Clevelanders willing to take a risk and do some major renovations, they're virtually giving the houses away.
I'd like to show you a home that is $8,400. Great investor's dream right here.
And young professionals in Cleveland can get a really great downtown condo at a price that will make people who live in other big cities green with envy.
We're in the common area right now, which is just gorgeous. I'm going to send you up to a unit that's a two-bedroom, two-bath. That's $279,900. It's a little over 1,200 square feet. It's got granite. It's got stainless steel, hardwood flooring, and great views.
Cleveland's also a diverse city with lots of great ethnic neighborhoods. The people who live in these neighborhoods are the descendants of immigrants who originally came to Cleveland when the economy was thriving.
On any given weekend in summer, you can throw a rock and hit two different, you know, the polka festival.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Greek festival. Yeah.
I love the neighborhoods. I love the people. I love the food.
The restaurants in Little Italy, if you haven't been there, you must go there.
Clevelanders looking for live music can find cool jazz at the Nighttown Jazz Club on the east side, and great blues and a working class vibe at the Parkview Nightclub on the west side of town.
Tell us about the Parkview Nightclub. What's the history of the Parkview?
Oh, a lot of history. This bar's been around since Prohibition and before. This whole neighborhood is littered with speakeasies, you know, the remains of speakeasies. So this bar was in a kind of a crazy neighborhood.
One of our favorite joints in Cleveland is a one-of-a-kind place called the Velvet Tango Room.
You're at the Velvet Tango Room, which is a very unique cocktail lounge in Cleveland.
And the mission of the Velvet Tango Room is to keep alive, burning bright, the flame of cocktail culture.
Classic cocktails, not cocktails that taste like gummy bears. We're the torchbearers of what a classic cocktail should be.
Cleveland also has hidden gems like Ray's Indoor Mountain Bike Park, the only one of its kind in the whole world.
It was a dream of mine for years, and then I had an opportunity, and I found some space, and just threw the dice, spent my life savings.
Since the first time I've come here, Ray's has been what I think just is the happiest place on bikes that I've ever been around. Everyone's riding. You have three-year-old kids, to old men, and moms, and dads, and pros, and it's great.
It's really worked out really well, and it's all about just having fun.
And as anyone who's visited Cleveland will tell you, Clevelanders are very good people.
The great part is the way the people treat you. You know, it's like very friendly. Everybody's happy-go-lucky. Okay. You know?
Maybe the most important thing that I like about Cleveland is the people, and the people are down-to-earth, and they'll tell you like it is. And they have a good time.
Clevelanders certainly know how to have a good time on St. Patrick's Day. But when the party's over, the city empties out again. Are there any signs of a turnaround? Not really. In fact, according to a recent study, 60% of Ohio's college students plan to leave the state when they graduate. Many of them will move to cities like Houston.
When you look at Houston, you say, why do people go there? Well, they don't go for the topography. They don't go for the climate. They go to Houston for opportunity. That's what it's all about. All great cities are aspirational. They are places where people go because things could be better for them.
I would like everybody in Cleveland to have like rich kid syndrome, where they feel guilty, you know, that they had all these opportunities and they have to go to Nicaragua now to do some work in the summer when they're off from college to make up for it.
In order to compete with other cities, Cleveland must deal with its most fundamental issues. For starters, the city needs to fix the schools, make government more efficient, and create a more business-friendly environment.
I think the city could be conceivably a lot better, but I think it's going to have to let go a lot of its older dysfunctional ideas.
This is one of the problems that almost all these old industrial cities have had. A very concentrated decision-making process, very bureaucratic.
Well, I think one thing that the city needs to do is back off a little bit and recognize that real, sustainable economic development has to be organic and has to occur bottom-up.
At the end of the day, city officials need to let go of their bureaucratic inclinations and find ways to make Cleveland the kind of city where people are free to pursue their own versions of the American dream.
It needs to be a freer city than it is today.
It'll work out on its own. I'm telling you, that Adam Smith invisible hand is a really good thing. There's nothing to be afraid of.
We'll be right back.
You gotta be down.